And then we have also the states that wanted to protect abortion right access. Those have continued to have in place. The slide actually says 6 states have the shield laws. It's now up to 8 states. And those laws, generally speaking, they do a range of things. But for the most part, and along with the executive orders, they'll say things like, you know, we're not going to extradite people for crimes that relate to services that are healthcare services that are lawful in our state. A number of them also protect transgender care, gender transitions, that sort of thing. A few go further to create counterclaims and some complicated things, layers of protection. But, you know, if you are in one of those specific states, they can be helpful, particularly as you're planning what you want to do. So it's important to keep track of where what protections your state may or may not provide for you against some of these other laws.
Yeah, I mean, we've said pretty much all of this. It's just sort of a summary. Again, part of this whole exercise is for organizations to keep tabs on applicable, laws, legislation, et cetera, that's impacting either their direct activities or, even if they're not a reproductive justice-oriented organization, offer those employees health insurance or other benefits, and how does that all need to be considered? So various places where all of this might come into play. You know, I think Pierce has really done a good job of outlining it all, but sort of if you're putting them in buckets, there's these sort of civil bounty laws that are, you know, somewhat limited in scope right now, but, you know, who knows? State fiduciary duties, we'll talk more about that, but just a place to, you know, if you're an organization in a particular state and you're pondering, trying to see the future, where might this all start? Where might the post-Dobbs world start impacting? There's a lot of, and I don't know if you guys were all in like the NASCO conversation, there are other places for state regulators to kind of infiltrate the operations or the governance of an organization. And so, you know, boards just anyway, pre-Dobbs, have sort of evolving roles in how both the public and your own employees view your roles on, you know, ESG or other political issues. That's just kind of an evolving, you know, societal situation. And then, you know, as we've said, litigation from kind of many places is possible, hence our coming soon, our exciting indemnification discussion. And then, you know, I think Alexander was talking earlier today sort of about the zombie or, you know, these pre-Dobbs laws that are all still technically, or a lot of them are still technically on the books, and they may or may not be conflicting with current laws, and there's just a smorgasbord, and so in one particular state, you might have no idea if it was like the 1800s law or the brand new law, and how do they overlap? So, and then, of course, the trigger laws that, you know, I think have been talked about a lot in the media. So yeah.
The zombie laws are really fascinating. They've ultimately, a lot of them have come down to, again, who has the power to bring prosecutions as to whether they're really at play or not. So Wisconsin, for instance, has one. And they have a Democratic governor and a Democratic AG, and they've basically said, we're not going to try to enforce this law. It still exists, though. It's still in the books. Arizona had one as well. The election produced by a very narrow margin, a Democratic AG who said she was not going to enforce that law. But there also, that was shortly followed by an appeals court, Arizona appeals court decision, that said it can only be used in very narrow circumstances anyway, because it was trying to interpret how do you make the Arizona law, which was passed before Arizona even became a state and bans all forms of abortion, how do you interpret that alongside the fact that Arizona had passed a 15-week abortion ban just the year before? You know, that's a difficult. And when they'd passed that 15-week abortion ban, had said in that law, by the way, we're not repealing this old law. So the court had to sort of walk this really fine line, and I wouldn't really want to be in their shoes to try to do that. But they issued an interesting and well-reasoned decision that tried to walk that. I talk about this every day, so I apologize if I missed really one of the really fundamental questions, which is, you know, we're talking about all these criminal laws. And you might be thinking, well, why does that really matter to me? Because these laws, for the most part, they're criminal. The criminal laws, they only penalize the individual who provides the abortion. right? That's the way they're written. And nearly all of them also explicitly exempt the woman who receives the abortion from being prosecuted. So if you're not directly in the business of providing reproductive health services, you know, how are you impacted by these? And the answer is that there are, because they're criminal, a lot of the state's general conspiracy and aiding and abetting laws would also apply in this situation. So we're concerned, we don't have clarity, and this is all, we're all trying to sift through this as best we can. There is a concern, a legitimate concern, that someone could use those conspiracy or aiding and abetting laws, general ones, to try to come after, say, an employer who gave the employee or reimbursed the employee for receiving those reproductive health services. We think that the odds of that occurring are unlikely. We think the risks are pretty low, but they still exist, and that's why we're tracking them, and that's why we're still talking about them, in addition to those states like Texas and Oklahoma that explicitly say this is aiding and abetting.